But he had tried hard. His investigation had been meticulous, painstaking. The first victim had been the owner of a textile plant, a specialist involved in some new chemical process for cotton. The second victim was the first guy's foreman. He had left the first guy's operation and was trying to raise seed money to start up on his own. The next six victims were government people, EPA employees. They had been running a case out of their New Orleans office. The case concerned pollution in the Mississippi Delta. Fish were dying. The cause was traced 250 miles upriver. A textile processing plant in Mississippi State was pumping chemicals into the river, sodium hydroxide and sodium hypochlorite and chlorine, all mixing with the river water and forming a deadly acidic cocktail. All eight victims had died the same way. Two shots to the head with a silenced automatic pistol, a .22 caliber, neat and clinical. Speranza had assumed they were professional hits. He went after the shooter two ways. He called in every favor he could and shook all the trees. Professional hitmen are thin on the ground. Speranza and his buddies talked to them all. None of them knew a thing. Speranza's second approach was the classic approach. Figure out who is benefiting. Didn't take him long to piece it together. The textile processor up in Mississippi State looked good. He was under attack from the eight who died. Two of them were attacking him commercially. The other six were threatening to close him down. Speranza pulled him apart, turned him inside out. He was on his back for a year. The paperwork in my hand was a testimony to that. Speranza had pulled in the FBI and the IRS. They had searched every cent in every account for unexplained cash payments to the elusive shooter. They had searched for a year and found nothing. On the way, they turned up a lot of unsavory stuff. Speranza was convinced the guy had killed his wife. Plain beat her to death was his verdict. The guy had married again, and Speranza had faxed the local police department with a warning. The guy's only son was a psychopath, worse than his father, in Speranza's view, a stone-cold psychopath. The textile processor had protected his son every step of the way, covered for him, paid his way out of trouble. The boy had records from a dozen different institutions, but nothing would stick. New Orleans FBI had lost interest. Speranza had closed the case, forgotten all about it, until an old detective from an obscure Georgia jurisdiction had faxed him, asking for information on the Kleiner family. Finley closed his file, spun his barber chair to face mine. "The Kleiner Foundation is bogus," he said. "Totally bogus. It's a cover for something else. It's all here. Gray busted wide open. Ordered it from top to bottom. The foundation is spending millions every year, but its audited income is zero. Precisely zero." He selected a sheet from the file, leaned over, passed it over to me. It was a sort of balance sheet showing the foundation's expenditures. "See that?" he said. "It's incredible. That's what they're spending." I looked at it. The sheet contained a huge figure. I nodded. "Maybe a lot more than that," I said. "I've been down here 5 days, right? Prior to that, I was all over the States for 6 months. Prior to that, I was all over the world. Margrave is by far the cleanest, best-maintained, most manicured place I've ever seen. It's better looked after than the Pentagon or the White House. Believe me, I've been there. Everything in Margrave is either brand new or else perfectly renovated. It's completely perfect. It's so perfect, it's frightening. That must cost an absolute fortune. He nodded. And Margrave is a very weird place, I said. It's deserted most of the time. There's no life, there's practically no commercial activity in the whole town. Nothing ever goes on. Nobody is earning any money. He looked blank, didn't follow. Think about it, I said. Look at Enos, for example. Brand new place. Gleaming, state-of-the-art diner. But he never has any customers. I've been in there a couple of times. There were never more than a couple of people in the place. The waitresses outnumber the customers. So, how is Eno paying the bills? The overhead, the mortgage. Same goes for everywhere in town. Have you ever seen lines of customers rushing in and out of any of the stores? Finlay thought about it, shook his head. Same goes for this barber shop, I said. I was in here Sunday morning and Tuesday morning. The old guy said they had had no customers in between. No customers. In 48 hours. I stopped talking then. I thought about what else the old guy had said. That gnarled old barber. I suddenly thought about it in a new light. The old barber, I said. He told me something. It was pretty weird. I thought he was crazy. I asked him how they make a living with no customers. He said they don't need customers to make a living because of the money they get from the Kleiner Foundation. So I said, what money? He said $1,000. He said all the merchants get it. So I figured he meant some kind of a business grant. $1,000 a year, right? Finlay nodded. Seemed about right to him. I was just chatting, I said. Like you do in the barber's chair. So I said, $1,000 a year is okay, but it's not going to keep the wolf from the door. Something like that, right? You know what he said then? He shook his head and waited. I concentrated on remembering the old guy's exact words. I wanted to see if he would dismiss it as easily as I had done. He made it sound like a big secret, I said. Like he was way out on a limb, even to mention it. He was whispering to me. He said he shouldn't tell me, but he would, because I knew his sister. You know his sister? Finlay asked, surprised. No, I don't, I said. He was acting very confused. On Sunday I had been asking him about Blind Blake, you know, the old guitar player, and he said his sister had known the guy 60 years ago. From that, he'd got mixed up. Must have thought I'd said I knew his sister. So what was the big secret? He said. He said it wasn't $1,000 a year, I said. He said it was $1,000 a week.
$1,000 a week? Finlay said. A week? Is that possible?
I don't know, I said. At the time, I assumed the old guy was crazy, but now, I think he was just telling the truth.
$1,000 a week, he said again.
That's a hell of a business grant.
That's $52,000 a year. That's a hell of a lot of money, Reacher. I thought about it, pointed at the total on Gray's audit. They'd need figures like that, I said. If this is how much they're spending, they'd need figures like that just to get rid of it all.
Finlay was pensive, thinking it through. They bought the whole town, he said. Very slowly, very quietly. They've bought the whole town for $1,000 a week here and there.
Right, I said. The Kleiner Foundation has become the golden goose. Nobody will run the risk of killing it. They all keep their mouths shut and look away from whatever needs looking away from.
Right, he said. The Kleiners could get away with murder.
I looked at him. They have got away with murder, I said.
So what do we do about it? Finley said.
First, we figure out exactly what the hell they're doing, I said. He looked at me like I was crazy.
We know what they're doing, right?
He said. They're printing a shitload of funny money up in that warehouse. I shook my head at him.
No, they're not, I said. There's no serious manufacturer of counterfeit money in the U.S. Joe put a stop to all that. The only place it happens is abroad.
So, what's going on?
Finley asked. I thought this was all about counterfeit money. Why else would Joe be involved?
Roscoe looked over at us from the bench in the window.
It is all about counterfeit money, she said. I know exactly what it's all about. Every last little detail.
She held up Gray's file in one hand.
Part of the answer is in here, she said.
Then she picked up the barber's daily newspaper with the other hand.
And the rest of the answer is in here, she said.
Finley and I joined her on the bench, studied the file she had been reading. It was a surveillance report. Gray had hidden out under the highway cloverleaf and watched the truck traffic in and out of the warehouses. 32 separate days. The results were carefully listed in three parts. On the first 11 occasions, he'd seen one truck a day incoming from the south, arriving early in the morning. He'd seen outgoing trucks all day long, heading north and west. He had listed the outgoing trucks by destination, according to their license plates. He must have been using field glasses. The list of destinations was all over the place, a complete spread from California all the way up and over to Massachusetts. Those first 11 days, he had logged 11 incoming trucks and 67 outgoing. An average of one truck a day coming in, six going out. Small trucks, maybe a ton of cargo in a week. The first section of Gray's log covered the first calendar year. The second section covered the second calendar year. He'd hit out on 9 separate occasions. He'd seen 53 outgoing trucks, the same 6 a day as before, with a similar list of destinations. But the log of incoming trucks was different. In the first half of the year, one truck a day was coming in like normal. But in the second half of the year, the deliveries picked up. They built up to 2 trucks a day, incoming. The final 12 days of his surveillance were different again. They were all from the final 5 months of his life. Between last fall and February, he was still logging about 6 trucks a day going out to the same wide spread of destinations. But there were no incoming trucks listed at all. None at all. From last fall, stuff was being moved out, but it wasn't coming in.
So?
Finley asked Roscoe. She sat back and smiled. She had it all figured.
It's obvious, right?
She said.
They're bringing counterfeit money into the country. It's printed in Venezuela, some place Kleiner set up alongside his new chemical place there. It comes in by boat and they're hauling it up from Florida to the warehouse in Margrave. Then they're trucking it north and west, up to the big cities, L.A., Chicago, Detroit, New York, Boston. They're feeding it into the cash flows in the big cities. It's an international counterfeit money distribution network. It's obvious, Finley.
Is it? He said.
Of course it is, she said again. Think of Sherman Stoller. He drove up and down to Florida to meet the boat coming in from the sea. at Jacksonville Beach. He was on his way out there to meet the boat when he got picked up for speeding on the bridge, right? That's why he was so agitated. That's why he got the fancy lawyer out so fast, right?
Finley nodded.
It all fits, she said. Think of a map of the states. The money is printed in South America, comes here by sea, lands in Florida, flows up the southeast, and then sort of branches out from Margrave, flows on out to L.A. in the west, up to Chicago in the middle, New York and Boston in the east. Separate branches, right? It looks like a candelabra or a menorah. You know what a menorah is?
Sure, Finley said. It's that candlestick Jewish people use.
Right, she said. That's how it looks on a map. Florida to Margrave is the stem. Then the individual arms lead out and up to the big cities. L.A., across to Chicago, across to Boston. It's an import network, Finley.
She was giving him plenty of help. Her hands were tracing menorah shapes in the air. The geography sounded okay to me. It made sense. An import flow rolling north in trucks up from Florida. It would need to use that knot of highways around Atlanta to branch itself out and head for the big cities in the north and west. The menorah idea was good. The left-hand arm of the candlestick would have to be bent out horizontally to reach L.A., like somebody had dropped the thing and somebody else had accidentally stepped on it. But the idea made sense. Almost certainly Margrave itself was the pivot. Almost certainly that warehouse was the actual distribution center. The geography was right. Using a sleepy, nowhere place like Margrave as the distribution center would be smart. And they would have a huge amount of available cash. That was for sure. Forged cash. But it would spend just the same. And there was a lot of it. They were shipping a ton a week. It was an industrial-scale operation. Huge. It would explain the Kleiner Foundation's massive spending. If they ever ran short, they could just print some more. But Finley still wasn't convinced.
What about the last 12 months? He said.
There's been no import flow at all. Look at Gray's list. The incoming deliveries didn't happen. They stopped exactly a year ago. Sherman Stoller got laid off, right? There's been nothing coming up for a year. But they're still distributing something. There were still 6 trucks a day going out. Nothing coming in but 6 trucks a day going out? What does that mean? What kind of an import flow is that?
Roscoe just grinned at him and picked up the newspaper. The answer's in here, she said. It's been in the papers since Friday. The Coast Guard. Last September, they started their big operation against smuggling, right? There was a lot of advance publicity. Kleiner must have known it was coming, so he built up a stockpile ahead of time. See Gray's list? For the 6 months before last September, he doubled the incoming deliveries. He was building up a stockpile in the warehouse. He's kept on distributing it all year. That's why they've been panicking about exposure. They've been sitting there on top of a massive stockpile of counterfeit money for a year. Now the Coast Guard is going to abandon its operation, right? So they can start importing again as usual. That's what's going to happen on Sunday. That's what poor Molly meant when she said, we have to get in before Sunday. We have to get in the warehouse while the last of the stockpile is still in there.
22. Finley nodded. He was convinced. Then he smiled. He stood up from the bench in the barbershop window and took Roscoe's hand, shook it very formally.
Good work, he said to her.
A perfect analysis. I always said you were smart, Roscoe. Right, Reacher?
Didn't I tell you she's the best we got?
I nodded and smiled, and Roscoe blushed. Finley held on to her hand and kept on smiling. But I could see him combing backward and forward through her theory, looking for loose ends. He only found two.
What about Hubble?
He asked.
Where did he fit in? They wouldn't recruit a bank executive just to load trucks, would they?
I shook my head. Hubble used to be a currency manager, I said. He was there to get rid of the fake money. He was feeding it into the system. He knew where it could be slipped in, where it was needed. Like his old job, but in reverse. He nodded.
What about the air conditioners? He asked.
Sherman Stallo was hauling them to Florida. That woman told you.
We know that's for real because you saw two old cartons in her garage, and his truck was full of them when the Jacksonville PD searched it. What was that all about?
Legitimate business, I guess, I said. Like a decoy. It concealed the illegal part. Like camouflage. It explained the truck movements up and down to Florida. They would have had to run south empty otherwise. Finley nodded.
Smart move, I guess, he said. No empty run. Makes sense. Sell a few air conditioners, it makes money both ways, right?
He nodded again and let go of Roscoe's hand.
We need samples of the money, he said.
I smiled at him. I had suddenly realized something.
I've got samples, I said.
I put my hand in my pocket and pulled out my thick roll of hundreds, pulled one off the back of the roll and one off the front, gave the two banknotes to Finley.
These are their counterfeits, he said. Got to be, I said.
Charlie Hubble gave me a wad of hundreds for expense money. She probably got them from Hubble. Then I took another wad from those guys who were out looking for me Tuesday.
And that means they're counterfeit?
Finley said.
Why?
Think about it, I said. Kleiner needs operating cash. Why should he use real money? I bet he paid Hubble in counterfeit money, and I bet he gave those Jacksonville boys counterfeit money for their operating expenses, too. Finley held the 200s right up to the bright light in the window. Roscoe and I crowded him for a look.
Are you sure?
Roscoe said.
They look real to me.
They're fakes, I said. Got to be. Stands to reason, right? Hundreds are what fakers like to print. Anything bigger is hard to pass. Anything smaller isn't worth the effort. And why should they spend real bucks when they've got truckloads of forgeries available? We took a good look at them, peered at them, felt them, smelled them, rubbed them between our fingers. Finley opened up his billfold and pulled out 100 of his own. We compared the three notes, passed them back and forth. Couldn't see any difference at all.
If these are fakes, they're damn good, Finley said. But what you said makes sense. Probably the whole of the Kleiner Foundation is funded with fakes. Millions, every year.
He put his own 100 back in his billfold, slid the fakes into his pocket.
I'm going back to the station house, he said.
You two come in tomorrow, about noon. Teal will be gone for lunch. We'll take it from there. Roscoe and I drove 50 miles south to Macon. I wanted to keep on the move. It's a basic rule for safety. Keep moving around. We chose an anonymous motel on the southeastern fringe, as far from Margrave as you can get in Macon, with the city sprawl between us and our enemies. Old Mayor Teal had said a motel in Macon would suit me. Tonight he was right. We showered in cold water and fell into bed, fell into a restless sleep. The room was warm. We tossed around fitfully most of the night, gave it up and got up again with the dawn, stood there yawning in the half-light, Thursday morning.
felt like we hadn't slept at all. We groped around and got dressed in the dark. Roscoe put her uniform on. I put my old things on. I figured I'd need to buy some new stuff soon. I'd do it with Kleiner's forgeries.
"What are we going to do?"
Roscoe said. I didn't answer. I was thinking about something else.
"Richa," she said, "what are we going to do about all this?"
"What did Gray do about it?" I said.
"He hung himself," she said.
I thought some more.
"Did he?"
I asked her.
There was a silence.
"Oh, God,"
Roscoe said.
"You think there's some doubt about that?"
"Maybe," I said. "Think about it. Suppose he confronted one of them. Suppose he was found poking around somewhere he shouldn't have been."
"You think they killed him?"
she asked. There was panic in her voice.
"Maybe," I said again.
"I think they killed Joe and Stoller and the Morrisons and Hubble and Molly Beth Gordon. I think they tried to kill you and me. If somebody's a threat, they kill him. That's how Kleiner operates."
Roscoe was quiet for a while, thinking about her old colleague, Gray, the doer and patient detective. 25 years of meticulous work. A guy like that was a threat. A guy who took 32 patient days to cross-check a suspicion was a threat. Roscoe looked up and nodded.
"He must have made a wrong move," she said.
I nodded gently at her.
"They lynched him," I said. "Made it look like suicide."
"I can't believe it," she said.
"Was there an autopsy?" I asked her.
"Guess so,"
she said. "Then we'll check it out," I said. "We'll have to speak to that doctor again, down in Yellow Springs."
"But he'd have said, right?"
she asked me.
"If he'd had doubts, wouldn't he have raised them at the time?"
"He'd have raised them with Morrison," I said. "Morrison would have ignored them, because his people had caused them in the first place. We'll have to check it out for ourselves." Roscoe shuddered.
"I was at his funeral," she said. "We were all there. Chief Morrison made a speech on the lawn outside the church. So did Mayor Teal. They said he was a fine officer. They said he was Margrave's finest. But they killed him."
She said it with a lot of feeling. She had liked Margrave. Her family had toiled there for generations. She was rooted. She had liked her job, enjoyed the sense of contribution. But the community she had served was rotten. It was dirty and corrupted. It wasn't a community. It was a swamp, wallowing in dirty money and blood. I sat and watched her world crumble. We drove north on the road between Macon and Margrave. Halfway home, Roscoe hung a right, and we headed for Yellow Springs down a back road, over toward the hospital. I was hungry. We hadn't eaten breakfast. Not the best state for revisiting the morgue. We swung into the hospital lot, took the speed bumps slowly, and nosed around to the back, parked up a little way from the big metal roller door. We got out of the car, stretched our legs on a roundabout route to the office door. The sun was warming the day up. It would have been pleasant to stay outside. But we ducked in and went looking for the doctor. We found him in his shabby office. He was at his chipped desk, still looking tired, still in a white coat. He looked up and nodded us in.
"Morning, folks," he said. "What can I do for you?"
We sat down on the same stools as Tuesday. I stayed away from the fax machine. I let Roscoe do the talking. Better that way. I had no official standing.
February this year, she said. My chief of detectives up at the Margrave PD killed himself. Do you remember?
Was that some guy called Gray? The doctor said.
Roscoe nodded, and the doctor got up and walked around to a file cabinet, pulled open a drawer. It was tight and made a screeching sound. The doctor ran his fingers backward over the files.
February, he said. Gray.
He pulled a file and carried it back to his desk, dropped it on his blotter, sat back down heavily and opened it up. It was a thin file, not much in it.
Gray, he said again. Yes, I remember this guy. Hung himself, right? First time we had a Margrave case in 30 years. I was called up to his house. In the garage, wasn't it, from a rafter?
That's right,
Roscoe said. She went quiet.
So, how can I help you? The doctor said.
Anything wrong with it? She asked.
The doctor looked at the file, turned a page.
Guy hangs himself, there's always something wrong with it, he said. Anything specially wrong with it? I said.
The doctor swung his tired gaze over from Roscoe to me.
Suspicious, he said.
He was nearly smiling the same little smile he had used on Tuesday.
Was there anything suspicious about it? I asked him.
He shook his head.
No, he said. Suicide by hanging, open and shut. He was on a kitchen stool in his garage, made himself a noose, jumped off the stool. Everything was consistent.
We got the background story from the local people up there.
I couldn't see a problem.
What was the background story?
Roscoe asked him. He swung his gaze back to her, glanced through the file.
He was depressed, he said. Had been for a while. The night it happened, he was out drinking with his chief, who was the Morrison guy we just had in here, and the town mayor up there, some guy called Teal. The three of them were drowning their sorrows over some case Gray had screwed up on. He got falling down drunk, and they had to help him home. They got him into his house and left him there. He must have felt bad. He made it to the garage and hung himself.
That was the story,
Roscoe said.
Morrison signed a statement, the doctor said. He was real upset. Felt he should have done more, you know. Stayed with him or something.
Did it sound right to you?
She asked him.
Well, I didn't know Gray at all, he said. This facility deals with a dozen police departments. I'd never seen anybody from Margrave before then. Quiet sort of a place, right? At least it used to be. But what happened with this guy is consistent with what usually happens. Drinking sets people off.
Any physical evidence? I asked him. The doctor looked back in the file, looked over at me.
Corpse stank of whiskey, he said. Some fresh bruising on the upper and lower arms, consistent with him being walked home by two men while inebriated. I couldn't see a problem.
Did you do a post-mortem?
Roscoe asked him. The doctor shook his head.
No need, he said. It was open and shut. We were very busy. Like I say, we have more to worry about down here than suicides over in Margrave. February, we had cases all over the place, up to our eyes. Your Chief Morrison asked for minimum fuss. I think he sent us a note. Said it was kind of sensitive. Didn't want Gray's family to know that the old guy had been blind drunk. Wanted to preserve some kind of dignity. It was okay with me. I couldn't see a problem, and we were very busy, so I released the body for cremation right away.
Roscoe and I sat looking at each other. The doctor stepped back to the cabinet and put the file away, closed the drawer with a screech.
Okay, folks, he said. If you'll excuse me, I've got things to do.
We nodded and thanked him for his time. Then we shuffled out of the cramped office, got back out into the warm fall sunshine, stood around blinking. We didn't speak. Roscoe was too upset. She had just heard about her old friend getting murdered.
I'm sorry, I said.
A bullshit story from beginning to end, she said. He hadn't just screwed up on a case. He never screwed up on any case. He wasn't especially depressed, and he didn't drink. Never touched a drop, so he certainly wasn't falling down drunk. And he would never socialize with Morrison or the damn mayor. He just wouldn't. He didn't like them. Never in a million years would he spend a social evening with them. And he had no family, so all that stuff about his family and sensitivity and dignity is total bullshit. They killed him and bullshitted the coroner so he wouldn't look too closely.
I sat there in the car and let the rage pour out of her. Then she was quiet and still. She was figuring out how they had done it.
Do you think it was Morrison and Teal? She asked me.
And somebody else, I said. There were three guys involved. I figured the three of them went around to his place and knocked on the door. Gray opened up and Teal pulled the gun. Morrison and the third guy grabbed him and held him by the arms. That explains the bruising. Teal maybe poured a bottle of whiskey down his throat, or at least splashed it all over his clothes. They hustled him off to the garage and strung him up. Roscoe started the car and eased it out of the hospital lot. She drove slowly over the speed bumps. Then she swung the wheel and blasted up the road through the countryside toward Margrave.
They killed him, she said.
Just a simple statement.
Like they killed Joe. I think I know how you must be feeling.
I nodded. They'll pay for it, I said. For both of them.
You bet your ass, she said.
We fell silent, sped north for a while, then merged with the county road, a straight 12 miles up to Margrave.
Poor old Gray, she said. I can't believe it. He was so smart, so cautious.
Not smart enough, I said, or cautious enough. We've got to remember that. You know the rules, right? Don't be on your own. If you see somebody coming, run like hell, or shoot the bastard. Stick with Finley if you can, okay? She was concentrating on driving. She was doing a hell of a speed up the straight road, thinking about Finley.
Finley,
she repeated.
You know what I can't figure?
What? I said.
There's the two of them, right?
She said.
Teal and Morrison. They run the town for Kleiner. They run the police department. Between them, they run everything. Their chief of detectives is Gray, an old guy, a wise head, smart and stubborn. He's been there for 25 years, since well before any of this shit started up. They inherited him, and they can't get rid of him, so sure enough, one day their smart and stubborn detective sniffs them out. He's found out that something is going on, and they find out that he's found out. So they put him out of the way. They murder him to keep it all safe. Then what do they do next?
Go on, I said.
They hire in a replacement, she said. Finley, down from Boston, a guy who was even smarter and even more stubborn than Gray was. Why the hell would they do that? If Gray was a danger to them, then Finley would be twice as dangerous. So why did they do that? Why did they hire somebody even smarter than the last guy?
That's easy, I said. They thought Finley was really dumb.
Dumb, she said. How the hell could they think that?
So I told her the story Finley had told me on Monday over donuts at the convenience store counter, about his divorce, about his mental state at the time. What had he said?
He was a basket case. An idiot. Couldn't string two words together. Chief Morrison and Mayor Teal interviewed him, I told her. He thought it was the worst job application in history. He thought he had come across as an idiot. He was totally amazed they gave him the job. Now I understand why they did. They really were looking for an idiot. Roscoe laughed. That made me feel better.
God, she said, that's ironic. They must have sat down and planned it out. Gray was a problem, they said. Better replace him with a fool, they said. Better pick the worst candidate who applies, they said.
Right, I said. And they did. They picked a shell-shocked idiot from Boston. But by the time he turns up to start work, he's calmed down and turned back into the cool and intelligent guy he always was. She smiled about that for 2 miles. Then we crested a slight rise and began the long sweep down into Margrave. We were tensed up. It was like entering the battle zone. We'd been out of it for a while. Sweeping back into it didn't feel good. I had expected to feel better when I had identified the opposing players, but it wasn't what I had expected. It wasn't me against them, played out against a neutral background. The background wasn't neutral. The background was the opposition. A whole town was in it. The whole place was bought and paid for. Nobody would be neutral. We were barreling down the rise at 70 miles an hour toward a dangerous mess. More dangerous than I had expected. Roscoe slowed up at the town limit. The big Chevy glided onto Margrave's glassy blacktop. The magnolia and dogwood scrub to the left and right was replaced by velvet lawns and ornamental cherries, those trees with smooth, shiny trunks, like the bark was buffed by hand. In Margrave it probably was. The Kleiner Foundation was probably paying somebody a handsome salary to do it. We passed the neat blocks of stores, all of them empty and complacent, floating on an unearned thousand a week. We jinked around the village green with the statue of Caspar Thiel, wafted past the turn down to Roscoe's house with its smashed front door, past the convenience store, past the benches under the smart awnings, past the parkland where the bars and rooming houses had been back when Margrave was honest, then up to the station house. We pulled off into the lot and parked up. Charlie Hubble's Bentley was still there where I had left it. Roscoe killed the motor, and we sat for a minute. Didn't want to get out. We squeezed hands, her right, my left. A brief good luck gesture. We got out of the car, into battle. The station house was cool and deserted, except for Baker at his desk and Finlay on his way out of the Rosewood office and back. He saw us and hurried over. "Teal's back in 10 minutes," he said, "and we got a slight problem." He hustled us back to the office. We went in, and he shut the door. "Picard called," he said. "So what's the problem?" I said. "It's a safe house," he said, "where Charlie and the kids are hiding out. That situation has to stay unofficial, right?" "He told me that," I said. "He's out on a limb up there." "Exactly," he said. "That's the problem. He can't staff it. He needs somebody to be up there with Charlie. He's been doing duty himself, but he can't do any more. Can't take any more time out. And he feels it's not appropriate, you know. Charlie being a woman and the little girl and all. Kid's terrified of him." He looked over at Roscoe. She saw where the conversation was going.
"He wants me up there?" she asked.
"Just for 24 hours, Finlay said. "That's what he's asking for. Will you do it for him?" Roscoe shrugged, smiled.
Of course I will, she said. No problem. I can spare a day, as long as you promise to get me back when the fun starts, okay?
That's automatic, Finley said. Fun can't start until we've got the detail. And as soon as we've got the detail, Picard goes official, then he puts his own agents into the safe house. You come back here.
Okay, Roscoe said. When do I go?
Right now, Finley said. He'll be here any minute. She grinned at him.
So you already figured I'd agree to it? She said.
He grinned back at her. Like I told Reacher, he said. You're the best we got. She and I went back through the squad room and out through the glass doors. Roscoe took her valise out of the Chevy and set it on the curb.
See you tomorrow, I guess, she said.
You going to be okay? I asked her.
Sure, she said. I'm going to be fine. Can't get much safer than an FBI safe house, right? But I'm going to miss you, Reacher. I didn't figure to spend time apart just yet. I squeezed her hand. She kissed me on the cheek, just stretched up for a quick peck. Finley pushed the station house door open. I heard the suck of the rubber seal. He stuck his head out and called over to Roscoe.
You better give Picard an update, okay? He said.
Roscoe nodded to him.
Then we stood waiting in the sun. Didn't have to wait long. Picard's blue sedan squealed into the lot within a couple of minutes, bounced to a stop right next to us. The big guy folded himself out of the seat and stood up, just about blotted out the sun.
I appreciate this, Roscoe, he said to her. You're really helping me out.
No problem, she said. You're helping us out, right? Where is this place I'm going?
Picard grinned a harassed grin, nodded toward me.
I can't say where it is, he told her. Not in front of civilians, right? I'm way out of line already, and I'm going to have to ask you not to tell him afterward, okay? And Reacher, don't you press her about it, or Charlie, okay?
Okay, I said. I wouldn't press her about it. She'd tell me anyway.
Good,
Picard said. He nodded a busy goodbye and picked up Roscoe's bag, threw it onto his rear seat. Then the two of them got into the blue sedan and drove off, nosed out of the lot and headed north. I waved after them. Then the car was lost to sight. 23. Details, evidence gathering, surveillance, it's the basis of everything. You've got to settle down and watch long enough and hard enough to get what you need. While Roscoe made cups of coffee for Charlie Hubble and Finley sat in the Rosewood office, I was going to have to watch the warehouse operation. Long enough and hard enough until I got a feel for exactly how they did it. It could take me a full 24 hours. Could be Roscoe would get back before I did. I got in the Bentley and cruised up the 14 miles to the Cloverleaf, slowed down as I passed the warehouses. I needed to scout out a vantage point. The northbound on-ramp dived under the southbound off-ramp. There was a kind of low overpass, short, wide concrete pillars hoisted the road overhead. I figured the thing to do would be to hole up behind one of those pillars. I would be well hidden in the gloom, and the slight elevation would give me a good view of the whole warehouse area. That was my spot. I accelerated the Bentley up the ramp and carried on north to Atlanta. Took an hour. I was picking up a rough idea of the geography. I wanted the low-rent shopping area, and I found it easily enough. Saw the sort of street I wanted. Automobile customizers, pool table wholesalers, repossessed office furniture. I parked on the street in front of a storefront mission. Opposite me were two survival shops.
I picked the left-hand one and went in. The door worked the bell. The guy at the counter looked up. He was the usual type of guy. White man, black beard, camouflage fatigues, boots. He had a huge gold hoop in one ear. Looked like some kind of a pirate. He might have been a veteran, might just have wanted to be one. He nodded to me. He had the stuff I needed. I picked up olive fatigue pants and a shirt, found a camouflage jacket big enough to fit, looked at the pockets carefully. I had to get the Desert Eagle in there. Then I found a water canteen and some decent field glasses, humped the whole lot over to the cash desk and piled it up, pulled out my wad of hundreds. The guy with the beard looked at me. "I could use a sap," I said. He looked at me and looked at my wad of hundreds. Then he ducked down and hoisted a box up. Looked heavy. I chose a fat sap about 9 inches long. It was a leather tube, taped at one end for a grip, built around a plumber's spring, the thing they put inside pipes before they bend them. It was packed around with lead shot, an efficient weapon. I nodded, paid for everything, and left. The bell rang again as I pushed open the door. I moved the Bentley along 100 yards and parked up in front of the first automobile shop I saw advertising window tinting, leaned on the horn, and got out to meet the guy coming out of the door. "Can you put tints on this for me?" I asked him. "On this thing?" he said. "Sure, I can. I can put tints on anything." "How long?" I said. The guy stepped up to the car and ran his finger down the silky coachwork.
"Ooh, thing like this, you want a first-rate job," he said. "Take me a couple of days, maybe three."
"How much?" I said. He carried on, feeling the paint and sucked air in through his teeth, like all car guys do when you ask them how much.
"Couple of hundred," he said. "That's for a first-rate job, and you don't want anything less on a thing like this."
"I'll give you $250, I said. "That's for a better-than-first-rate job, and you loan me a car the 2 or 3 days it's going to take you to do it, okay?" The guy sucked in some more air and then slapped lightly on the Bentley's hood.
"It's a done deal, my friend," he said.
I took the Bentley key off Charlie's ring and exchanged it for an 8-year-old Cadillac the color of an old avocado pear. It seemed to drive pretty well, and it was about as anonymous as you could hope to get. The Bentley was a lovely automobile, but it was not what I needed if the surveillance went mobile. It was about as distinctive as the most distinctive thing you could ever think of. I cleared the southern rim of the city and stopped at a gas station, brimmed the old Cadillac's big tank, and bought candy bars and nuts and bottles of water. Then I used their toilet cubicle to get changed. I put on the military surplus gear and threw my old stuff into the towel bin, went back out to the car, put the Desert Eagle in the long inside pocket of my new jacket, cocked and locked. Poured the spare bullets into the outside top pocket. Morrison's switchblade was in the left side pocket, and I put the sap in the right. I shared the nuts and the candy bars around the other pockets, poured a bottle of water into the canteen, and went to work. Took me another hour to get back to Margrave. I drove the old Cadillac right around the Cloverleaf, up the on-ramp again, heading north. Backed up about 100 yards along the shoulder and stopped right in the no-man's land between the off-ramp and the on-ramp, where nobody would pass either leaving or joining the highway. Nobody would see the car except people shooting right past Margrave, and they wouldn't care. I popped the hood and propped it open, locked up the car and left it like that. It made it invisible, just a broken-down old sedan on the shoulder, a sight so ordinary you don't see it. Then I climbed over the low concrete wall at the edge of the shoulder, scrambled down the high bank, ran south, and sprinted across the on-ramp, carried on running for the shelter of the low overpass. I ran under the width of the highway to the other side and holed up behind a broad pillar. Over my head, the trucks coming off the highway rumbled around to the old county road. Then they ground their gears and branched right for the warehouses. I settled back and got comfortable behind the pillar. I had a pretty good vantage point, maybe 200 yards distant, maybe 30 feet of elevation. The whole place was laid out below me like a diagram. The field glasses I'd bought were clear and powerful. There were actually four separate warehouses, all identical, built in a tight line, running away from me at an oblique angle. The whole area was ringed by a serious fence, plenty of razor wire at the top. Each of the four compounds had its own inner fence. Each inner fence had its own gate. The outer fence held the main gate fronting onto the road. The whole place was swarming with activity. The first compound was totally innocent. The big roller door stood open. I could see local farm trucks rattling in and out. People were loading and unloading in plain view. Sturdy burlap sacks bulging with something or other. Maybe produce. Maybe seed or fertilizer. Whatever farmers use. I had no idea. But there was nothing secret, nothing hidden. All the trucks were local. Georgia plates on all of them. No out-of-state vehicles. Nothing big enough to roll south to north along the height of the nation. The first compound was clean. No doubt about that. Same went for the second and third. Their gates stood open, their doors were up. All their activity was a cheerful swarm on their forecourts. Nothing secret, all in plain view. Different type of trucks, but all local. Couldn't see what they were hauling. Wholesale stuff for the little country stores, maybe. Possibly manufactured goods going somewhere. Some kind of oil drums in the third shed, but nothing to get excited about. The fourth warehouse was the one I was looking for. The one at the end of the row. No doubt about it. It was a smart location. Made a lot of sense. It was screened by the chaos on the first three forecourts. But because it was the last in line, none of the local farmers or merchants would ever need to pass it by. Nobody would get a look at it. A smart location. It was definitely the one. Beyond it, maybe 75 yards away in a field, was the blasted tree, the one Roscoe had picked out of the photograph of Staller and Hubble and the yellow truck. A camera on the forecourt would pick up the tree just beyond the far corner of the structure. I could see that. This was the place. No doubt about it. The big roller door across the front was closed. The gate was closed. There were two gatemen hanging around on the forecourt. Even from 200 yards, the field glasses picked up their alert glances and the wary tension in their walks. Some kind of a security role. I watched them for a while. They strode around, but nothing was happening. So I shifted around to watch the road. Waited for a truck, bound for the fourth compound. It was a good long wait. I was uptight about the time ticking away, so I sang to myself. I went through every version of rambling on my mind that I knew. Everybody has a version. It's always listed as a traditional song. Nobody knows whose it was. Nobody knows where it came from. Probably from way back in the Delta. It's a song for people who can't stay around. Even though maybe there's a good reason to. People like me. I had been around Margrave practically a week.